All right. Welcome to another edition of the Kaiju Transmissions podcast. My name is Kyle Bird. With me as my co-host, as always,
Matt Parmley.
Yes. And today we're joined by a very special guest. We have the writer and director of the new Kaiju parody spoof film, Notzilla. We have Mr. Mitch Teemley on the podcast tonight. How you doing, Mitch?
I am doing excellent, thank you, despite the world that we live in at the moment.
Oh, the world's on fire, but nice to have you anyway. And yeah, we're gonna talk to him about his film and also just kind of get into the process that went behind making it and all that stuff. So Mitch, I guess let's just start from the beginning. I mean, tell us a little bit just about how you got involved in film and became a director.
Well, for starters, I started out as a happy little zygote. Somewhere really early in childhood, I just, like, without ever being told to or asked to, definitely not being asked to, I just started acting out stories. I was always, when I would see a movie, as early as I can remember, 4 or 5 years old, I'd see a movie, and the next day I'd be on the street in front of our house or the neighbors' houses at 6 in the morning, reenacting the movie, playing all the parts and doing the music. And I'm a story guy. I've always been a story guy. And without getting into the whole kaiju thing and where that comes from, I grew up loving movies. Side note, my other sort of big love besides storytelling, besides films, is music. And even then, my songs are story songs. So every time I do a movie, we always slip songs that I've written into it, too. And there are several in Notzilla. But I majored in theater, and I pretty quickly discovered that although I loved acting, and I'll always do some acting, that my big passion was being the person who told the story, who oversaw the whole thing and had the vision for it. But I kept coming back from theater to film, and one really distinctive moment for me was I was watching somebody else's play production, and it was of a kind of a famous play, a European drama called The Enemy of the People. And at the very ending of the story, a town that really pretty much sold their souls. They've sold out a good man for wealth to a corrupted multi-zillionaire. And in the ending, they're all parading around in their finery in front of their beautiful new city, but they've just really lost their souls. And I remember sitting there thinking, I want to be able to move in on their eyes and see the city right through their empty hearts, their empty eyes with nothing there, you know. And I realized, I want to control what people see. I want to take people into the story. And so not too long later, I started making short films. And eventually, after completing my grad degree in theater directing, and I did a lot of plays, I still love theater too, but I started working more on the film stuff and eventually moving into that, doing a lot of postgraduate study. It eventually, not exactly overnight, far from, but it eventually led to making feature films.
What is your personal history with kaiju movies? What led you to make a giant monster film?
It's kind of really what Notzilla is a very, very affectionate send-up of all the kaiju movies I saw at the local theater matinees on Saturday as a kid. They were on TV too. But you could go to the theater for ridiculous nothing, just nothing really. And you sneak in a big jug of root beer, and you string all the straws together so you can put it on the floor and suck it all the way up on the floor. And we'd sit there and watch double bills on Saturdays of Godzilla versus whoever he was versus this week, and Mothra and Rodan and King Ghidorah and all these. And they just were burned into my heart. I just love these guys. They were my friends, you know. And as I got older, because I was a kid in the era that Notzilla is set in, the early 60s, as I got older, I developed a real love for for spoofs, for parodies. I was a fan of Mel Brooks as a kid from the start, and later the Zucker Brothers, Airplane and Naked Gun and all those things. And so somewhere along the line, the idea of doing, actually really early on, the idea of doing a very affectionate send-up of kaiju movies struck me. It was actually the summer I graduated from high school. My best friend and I wrote a really a short film version. The original one was called Kraga. And it was basically almost a dead-on blow-for-blow of the original first Godzilla movie with, like I said, an affectionate send-up. So that was the germ of it.
Well, in terms of both comedy and monster movies, in both of those genres, are there any directors or films specifically that had a certain impact on you?
I can't honestly say there were any particular comedy monster movies that had an effect. I've seen some. I've seen a few. They're kind of, you know, some obscure ones, like there was a movie in the 70s called Schlock.
Yeah, the John Landis movie. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Back when he was cutting his teeth, you know, his film teeth. And I can't say any of those affected me all that much. Mel Brooks affected me. One of my favorite comedies of all time was Young Frankenstein. And while Young Frankenstein is a spoof of an entirely different genre, or at least a completely different genre of horror, sci-fi, you know, it's Brooks's faithfulness to the look and style that stuck with me. Modern spoofs have gotten away from that a bit. The Zucker Brothers really carried on more than anybody else when they did Airplane, and later when they did a very short-lived TV series called Police Squad that was just brilliant, and it laid the groundwork for the Naked Gun movies. And you know, although they'll go far afield for a gag. I mean, there's nothing about the Mayo Clinic gag in Airplane, which is, you know, a place with a bunch of jars of mayo on the shelf that is remotely like the 1970s Airplane disaster movies. They just had a dumb groaner they wanted to throw in. And I'll do that too. I'll throw in a groaner here and there that's really not particularly kaiju or even just old monster movie in flavor. Just if there's a laugh, I'm going for it, man, you know.
Have you kept up with some of the more modern kaiju films that have been coming out?
Not much. No, I can't honestly say that I'm tracking with the modern stuff, unless you're referring to the big budget remakes of the Godzilla movies.
Yeah, the stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. I've been catching those.
Yeah, how have you enjoyed those at all?
Oh, I mean, they're fun. The production values are great. I don't know, this something of the spirit.
They're entertaining enough, but yeah, I still, you know, I miss the suits and the models and all that.
Yeah, there's a Japanese movie. It's never been released in America, and it's not even a kaiju movie. But there's a fantasy dream sequence in it where Godzilla attacks. What's it called?
Yes, it's Always
that
2.
And I thought the Godzilla design in that, the movement, his air, even though it's just this little sequence in this film, the whole little sequence is absolutely, I've seen that. I've never seen the movie because it's never been released here. But that sequence was brilliant. That's what I wanted a new Godzilla movie to be like. Because it somehow captured the spirit of the old Godzilla movies, but was sophisticated in its style and look without abandoning that sense of a kaiju movie.
That makes a lot of sense. So I know that your film, Notzilla, had a pretty long history. Tell us how you came up with the original idea.
Like I said, it was the summer after I graduated from high school, so I was literally 18, and my best buddy Jeff and I had this idea to do, we were going to shoot at Super 8, and we were going to shoot it during the summer. It would have been wildly politically incorrect because it would have been a bunch of, you know, suburban non-Asian people, mostly playing Asians. The story was set in Japan and, you know, the monster attacks Tokyo, the whole bit. And I never made it. But then a year later, my sophomore year in college, I took a screenwriting course, my first screenwriting course. And the final project was for a full-length project. And I wrote a full-length expanded version of that script. The professor said, "This is brilliant. You've got to do this." And that was very encouraging. But a long, long, long time passed. I mean, this is the longest gestation period for any dinosaur on record. it really is. It, literally decades passed. And then before, not too long before, we moved to Cincinnati, Ohio 15 years ago when I still lived in the Los Angeles area and was working in the movie biz out there. I had written, did a complete page one rewrite of that script. That's when I changed the name to Notzilla. And I checked it out at the time. It was funny. I Googled it and nobody had ever used the term. I made it up and I thought that would be great. And it was kind of fun. You could tell just from the title that it was a comedy, you know. I pitched it, and one of the small indie divisions of Warner Brothers Pictures loved it, and it was going to be their next film. So it was actually green-lighted by a division of Warner Brothers, which I thought was pretty awesome. And then the movie they were making at the time when they green-lighted us went like 10 times over budget or something, and they lost their shirt, and Warner Brothers shut them down. So it never got made. And then it went back into mothballs, and many years later we moved to Cincinnati, Ohio. Long story there, but I won't get off on that sidetrack. And when I became involved with a production company based here in this area, St. Michael Movies, although they produced Notzilla under the pseudonym of Creepy Ex-Boyfriend Productions. when they were putting together their slate for the next couple of films, and I had done a very serious, heavy drama for them called Healing River that is also out right now. And Mike, the executive producer, was very happy with Healing River. It had been doing really well at festivals and things look good for it. And he said, "Let's do another movie together. What do you got?" Only they were in a real hurry because they needed to get the approval of the state film board in order to get it slated for production really, really soon. So there wasn't really time to start something from scratch. And I said, "Well, this is nothing like your other movies, but I've got this crazy, spoofy movie called Notzilla." And they were actually a faith-based company that makes subtly faith-based movies. Healing River is. And so that was really off task for them. But Mike took it to his board of directors, and they loved the idea. They said, "Hey, bake sale." And he said, "What?" We said, "You know, not everything a church does is a mass or a worship service or something. Like, sometimes they just have a bake sale to raise money. Let's make this our bake sale." So that was our working title for the movie at first, bake sale. And they green-lighted it, had some second thoughts along the way because it seemed so off task for them. We had to do massive changes. It got moved from Tokyo to Cincinnati, Ohio, so that we could find a way to have a bunch of people we could cast, because we have about three people who act, who are Asian, who live in Cincinnati. They're a wonderful base of actors living here, all kinds of white actors and black actors and pretty good number of Hispanic actors, and a fairly good smattering of Asian people. But Asian actors, skilled, trained Asian actors, are almost impossible to find. And so for practical reasons, locations, all of that kind of stuff, we found a way to move the story, which made it a little bit of a hybrid story, to move it here to America, to make it a kaiju movie that takes place in an American city in the early 60s. And the key to doing that was that our young hero, whose name is Hiro, it's actually Ichihiro Honda, which is a play on the name of the man that made the early Godzilla movies, Ichihiro Honda. And Hiro is a paleontologist who's trying to save the kaiju that are being killed off by the military. And just as they're killing the last surviving member of a particularly rare species of kaiju, a Nozillosaurus partiontildon, Hiro finds and rescues her last surviving child, her egg, actually, the strange red leathery egg, and he stuffs it in his satchel and swears to her as she's dying that he will save her baby and take it somewhere safe. So he looks on a map when he gets back to his apartment and spots a place in America called Ohio. And Ohio means hello in Japanese, which sounds really friendly. So he comes to America with a strange red egg of the last surviving Nozillosaurus partiontildon, which is how our story takes place here.
Getting to, I guess, the original idea, which I have vague memories about, was when at one point it was Nozilla, Duke of the Monsters, correct?
Yeah.
and from what I understand, the concept was it was going to be a fake lost film of some American actor and more of a direct, I guess, parody of the American version of Godzilla with Raymond Burr.
Yes.
Yeah. What can you tell us about that version? What exactly made you kind of drop that concept when you finally revived this project?
Well, initially, the reason for changing it was, like I said, the practical factors. When I originally wrote it, I lived in Southern California. There are lots and lots of Asian actors in the Los Angeles area. I mean, we're talking Hollywood here. So there's a huge casting base of actors of all ethnicities, and it would have been easy to cast an entire story with just one American character in the lead, whereas we've got the flip-flop of that now. And cast a bunch of really gifted, talented, comedic actors who happen to be Asian and were either Japanese American or able to pass for Japanese American. Also, you had the settings there. There's a whole very, very rich architectural couple of locations, not the least of which is Little Tokyo in Los Angeles. So we had locations picked out. We had I had an old, wizened Japanese scientist who was in the original version, and I had Pat Morita cast in that role. You remember Mr. Miyagi?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one of the joys of my life is we sent the screenplay to Pat Morita. Pat called the house, and he had just finished reading the script. He still had the script in his hand, and he called the house, and he said, "This is hot. I'm in."
That's great. And at exactly. One point, you had George Takei and Patrick Warburton. That's what the internet is telling me.
I had a verbal agreement from Takei's manager. We never got it in writing because it was still coming together, the deal. And we had not only attached Pat Morita, but Patrick Warburton to play the American bad guy. Now, the American bad guy's personality and character kind of changed. And he became the bad guy instead of the hero. He was sort of a bad hero in the original version. Like, he's supposed to be the protagonist, but you end up rooting for the monster instead. What ended up happening is when we got here, because for the practical reasons, the executive producer, Mike, said, "You need to re-envision this story here in America." And while we're at it, we did bring in fun little references and elements to old American monster movies of the era, too. Though it's still mainly, I mean, really in spirit, it's still a kaiju movie. There were the pragmatic aspects. But then as I got into it, I really started to love this story. There was a lot of stuff I could say about the spirit of the times here. There's a co-protagonist. She started out as the love interest, but she grew and grew until, along with Hiro, she became the co-protagonist, and that's Shirley Eugist, who is a gifted young nuclear physicist who's kept in the position of being an assistant to the director of the nuclear research program in 500 stories underneath the city of Tokyo, of Cincinnati, because of the fact that she's a woman and women can't be scientists. You know, so there's that whole glass ceiling element of the era that comes into play. And Hiro is a foreigner, and we're not that many years after the war. And there's prejudice against Japanese people. And then, of course, Godzilla is the ultimate outsider. So there's a whole kind of outsider thing. It's so deep. I mean, it's really so deep.
That fits, especially because, like, if you watch the old American B movies, like, yeah, the female characters are always, you know, really not treated very well. You know, they're usually secretaries or below somebody, and so yeah, it was a good, like, I guess, lampooning of that whole thing, you know. I know this version is obviously, you know, it's independent, very low budget. Did you try to get anyone like a George Takei or anyone on board with this version at all? I don't even know if that would have been possible.
I went back to Patrick because Patrick's a friend. Patrick, I mean, when we moved away from California, Patrick confirmed once again that, hey, if and when you get the funding to do this film, I'm still in. I had an undated form a letter of agreement from him that just said, hey, when you do this movie, I'm in. Again, Patrick did the same thing as Pat Morita did. He called me halfway through the script and said, I'm in. I love this. I wrote the part originally with him in mind. But when I did the rewrite, the character began to change dramatically. The character wasn't the protagonist anymore. He's really the antagonist, the bad guy. A real doofus of a bad guy, but a bad guy nevertheless. Arrogant and stupid. Dangerous combination. And as he began to morph into a different kind of a guy, it really wasn't based on what I had Patrick in mind for anymore. But also, this was, as you said, a low-budget indie movie. And Patrick's folks in L.A. really wouldn't agree to something in this budget range. And he told me on the phone very politely. He said, I'd love to do this, Mitch, but I can't do an end run around my manager unless you guys can bring it up to at least a low-end version of the budget you were going to do it at when you were doing it in L.A. for that division of Warner Brothers. Then I don't think they'll let me do it, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's, but unfortunately, that's not surprising. I feel like that happens a lot.
It does. And one of these days, I'll still cast Patrick. I love Patrick. He's one of the funniest guys on earth. He really is. And it just breaks my heart that dear Pat Morita died. He was such a brilliant, gifted actor, period, but also just a wonderful comedic actor.
And you held a script reading for that at G-Fest in 2010.
Yeah.
What made you decide to do that? And just, I'm usually there every year. I wasn't there that year. What was the turnout like and kind of the feedback that you got?
Well, I mean, it seemed to me that it was the first time I'd been, but it seemed to me the turnout was quite good. I felt like I was among my tribe. And so it made a lot of sense. You know, I could read the script to the kind of crowd that would be really a target audience for the movie. It was the old version. It was the version set in Tokyo with all Asian actors and just one American, one Anglo actor in the lead as the American character. But I read it there to see how people would respond to it and just to make connections. The one single most valuable connection I made while I was there was Jacob Baker, our Godzilla. Jacob was walking around in a Godzilla suit that he had made and blowing people away. Everybody was getting their picture taken because it was by far the best cosplay of any kaiju I had ever seen. And so I talked to him and his dad, Rick, and said, hey, listen, I've got this movie I'm developing, and if I can ever do it, would you be interested in creating and in inhabiting, being the stunt guy inside of the creature? And Jacob said, are you serious? Yes. And so we swapped phone numbers and emails and all that good stuff and stayed loosely in touch. Although when I called him about this production, when we finally got the green light to do this, it had been a while. But Jacob said, oh, I'm still in. I'm still in. And so I gave him all the design elements that I'd done when I was in L.A. And he went from there. He worked from there. All the comedic elements, you know, like a classic sort of kaiju, not really Godzilla, his own guy, dinosaur based, you know, but I don't mean to do spoilers, but, you know, with the zipper on the front and the kind of goggly eyes, not the menacing looking low hanging brows of Godzilla, but the big wide open eyes, because he's also brand new. He's newborn. He's really a toddler walking around the city. And then the fins are basically paper doll cutouts. And we just had fun with all these little gaggy elements. His tail ends in a sort of a happy face bludgeon. And Jacob just went with it. I mean, he's made so many of these guys. He's a real master craftsman and quite a skilled performer himself in the suit. He does some just really, really wonderful body language. He really becomes Godzilla.
So once the original project fell through, did you shop it around to other studios? Did you have any luck or bites with that?
Well, we did. We were very close to it once more in L.A. before we moved away. Because when I lived in L.A., I worked in the biz, and everybody took my calls, even if they didn't say yes to my projects. So I had meetings with the studios and the networks, and one of the places that was very interested, although I don't know if there's anybody left there who remembers this now, but the guy whose job was to screen projects and decide what to put on the docket for the final decision, the director of development there, loved Godzilla. He just thought it was great. They had been really, really successful with Scary Movie. In fact, Scary Movie was originally done to be a spoof of, what's the original?
Scream?
I know what you did.
With Scream.
It was Scream. Right. Yeah.
They made the Scream movies, and Scary Movie was an in-joke. It was an in-house spoof of the Scream movies produced by the people that made the Scream movies. And it turned out to make more money at the box office than the Scream movies did. So boom, they were ready to make sequels. So they had cranked out a couple more sequels. And he was saying, look, we're running dry here. Obviously, we've got an audience for this kind of a spoof. Let's look around. And my script arrived for Godzilla. And he said, this is it. And he pitched it to the head honchos. And it made it to the last stage, the table. And it was down to whether to do, I think, Scary Movie 4 or Godzilla. And it was about 52% to 48%. We lost by just an eyelash. And so Godzilla went back into mothballs, and they made more Scary Movies. I ran out of funds at that point, and we did a big career shift. I relocated my family to Cincinnati, Ohio, Godzilla went into mothballs, but after the Great Recession in 2009, I lost the job that I came here to do in Cincinnati, and I had been doing a lot of short films on the side, and a bunch of people knew that, and they said, "Look, we'll get you started. We'll fund you. We'll put up the seed money for this, and let's start a production company. Let's get back into making movies." So we did. We launched a production company called Mariah Media, but we could never put together enough funds to make features. And so we were doing short films for churches, actually, because I'd been on staff at a church and done all kinds of creative stuff there, short films and scripts for church drama teams and things that we could produce on a shoestring. And then I ended up getting cast in the lead of a faith-based feature film that this company, St. Michael Movies, was doing. And became friends with executive producer of the film. And he said, oh, I know you develop films. I know you're a screenwriter and a director. What do you got? And that was when I pitched the movie that became Healing River, which is doing incredibly well right now. It's the highest rated faith-based film on Amazon Prime and has been all summer. And that was, you know, that's what laid the groundwork. It was really, really well received. And so a year later, he said, let's talk about what you're going to do next. And that led to this complete switch. So I'm in a position right now of having a heavy faith-based drama and a totally just-for-laughs, non-faith-based comedy.
That's quite the dichotomy. I know at one point Toho approached you, right? How did you go submitting the idea of Knotzilla to them?
Submitting the idea to St. Michael?
To Toho. Did you have any interaction with Toho Studios?
Toho. Yeah, way back. Yeah, when I still lived in Burbank in L.A., when I was pitching to various places, I pitched to Toho. I thought, hey, what the heck, you know? They might be interested in spoofing their own movies, just the way the folks that did Scream spoofed their own movies with Scary Movie. Certainly, there's probably an audience for that too, you know. But they took it I was dealing with the business department, you know, and the people that were given the job of looking at pitches basically said, thank you, we wish you well with your movie. I've got a letter of congratulations from them saying, you know, good for you, but this isn't really the kind of thing we do. We don't want to do spoofs. And so, you know, go, Godspeed, have fun, and see you at the box office and whatever. And so they let us go at that, and that was that. That was the end of the thing with Toho. Another reason, by the way, why we ended up moving further away from directly spoofing the original Godzilla movies is not only the character of the monster himself, but also the storyline and all that needed to be really completely fresh and original, not something that was a direct beat by beat or even close to that of any of the kaiju movies, particularly the original Godzilla. So we just went a whole other way.
You mentioned a couple of times how this had been on the shelf for decades. Why do you think now was the right time to be able to revive the project?
Well, honestly, our executive producer, even though it's a relatively tiny company in comparison to the studios in LA, our executive producer, Mike Mergler, goes with his gut. He really does. He has a grandson who spends a lot of time with him, and his grandson, Landon, is mad for kaiju movies, anything and everything Godzilla. And we had produced, Jeff Barklage, the director of photography of Knotzilla, and I became friends because Jeff is a longtime kaiju fan, loves old style special effects, rear screen projection, guy in the suit, the whole bit. And so Jeff and I, on a shoestring, really nothing, not even a shoestring, just in one day back in 2011, shot a teaser trailer for the older version idea of Knotzilla. And I think maybe Mike showed that to his grandson, Landon. And Landon said, Grandpa, you have to do this movie. This will be the greatest thing ever. And Mike came back and said, well, I think maybe God has spoken. So in a way, the movie was green-lighted by an 11-year-old.
That's actually pretty awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was there any kind of, I guess, anxiety? Because you'd mentioned, you know, Warner Brothers, the company that made Scary Movie, you know, actual, like, these studios that were interested, and then now you're doing it as this small independent film. Was there any kind of anxiety or trepidation in just deciding to do it, you know, I'll just do it myself with less money?
Yeah, there was. Definitely. We had to decide stylistically how we could do that. I'd initially envisioned it looking a lot closer to the Toho films. The Toho films are done with a great deal of finesse. The miniatures are incredibly detailed. The sets are huge for the kaiju movies made in all the more over the years. But even back, starting with the very first original Godzilla movie, even though they were figuring it out as they went along, what a lot of people don't realize is Toho's huge. They are the Disney, the Warner Brothers of Japan. They had, even back then, they were the biggest film production company in Japan. They had made Seven Samurai. They were legendary, and this was kind of a departure even for them. But they had enough budget that it allowed them to build massive sets, and they shot, for anybody who's really into that whole thing knows, they shot quite a lot of failed footage before they got Godzilla right. They had to keep recreating and figuring it out as they went along. They initially thought they were going to do it stop motion, like Western monster movies had done, but they realized they didn't have the time. They didn't want to spend that kind of time, because stop motion is painstakingly slow. And so they adopted the kaiju style that we know today, which has become as classical an art form in Japan as no theater or, kabuki. But they developed this approach, and they built these lavish sets, and they sunk a lot of money, huge crew, and a lot of time into it. And that was the one thing I couldn't match with the budget that we had in the time frame when we had on this film. So we decided to be more playful, to go a little more over the top with the look, with the toys. They look a little more like toys. We play with the fact that there are toys. There's a giving away a small gag for those who haven't seen the movie. There's a scene where we're scanning the military standing on a cliff waiting for the monster to arrive, and they're green plastic army soldiers. Mm-hmm. And we're making fun of that, but that's not what Toho never did that. Their stuff had a lot more finesse than that.
The one I like is when he grabs all the planes by the strings and cuts them down.
Oh, well, that was... I mean, that's a real example of us making fun of ourselves.
Yeah.
It's a lot of that, yeah.
How much overlap was there between the Duke of the Monsters version and this one? Were there any... are there any favorite jokes or anything that survived between the two?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were. The lead characters changed. The leading lady is a completely different leading lady. The leading man is a completely different leading man. So whole big chunks of character development and the story arc based on the relationships of these characters versus the old ones were there. And a lot of the humor in that this version of the movie is original because of the character changes. But the monster and the monster getting away, the monster being exposed, the monster being a species of dinosaur who survived since the ancient era, that is normally, as Hiro describes it, all only about the size of a man, say, in a rubber suit. He's exposed to alcohol. This particular species of dinosaur, it screws up their metabolism. Unfortunately, they love the taste of it because they would hunt out fermented kaiju berries in Japan. And in the process, it messes up their metabolism and makes the pseudoscience stuff, It makes them grow to extraordinary size. And so that was kept. And he's exposed to alcohol. And then he goes looking for more beer. At one point when he finally finds what he sees is a beer can that's his size. He's like 120 feet tall by now. And he pops the top off of a brewery tower and goes on happily chugging. And so those elements were there from the original. And a lot of the sight gags... and I don't want to start going into all of them and do lots of little spoilers for anybody that hasn't seen it yet, but a lot of the sight gags and his progress towards the city as the monster gets closer and closer to the city, cue dramatic music, a lot of those sight gags, big battle scene and all that, were from the previous version of the script.
Pivoting a bit, just what was your process like for casting I know it's mostly people from the Cincy scene, but what was the process like in, you know, selecting the roles for the film?
Well, we actually have a pretty professional casting system here. There are a number of casting directors in the area, but our casting director on this, Lynn Meyer, is the casting director for Hollywood movies. So whenever a Hollywood movie is shot in Cincinnati, and quite a few are shot here, some major films are shot here, Lynn is the one that does all the local casting. They'll cast the movie stars, the people whose names are above the title, and maybe some of the secondary leads in Hollywood. And they'll generally bring in the major, like the director of photography and the production designer and so on from Hollywood. But they will go, they'll cast all the supporting people, the crews, the smaller roles, all of that is done here. And all the casting for those roles typically is given to Lynn Meyer casting. She's also the director of one of the Cincinnati's major professional theaters, Ensemble Theater Company. And Lynn's just wonderful. We've worked with her again and again. So Lynn did what casting directors in Hollywood or New York or Chicago do. And she pulled in all the people she thought were the best choices from submissions of actors by the local acting agents, just the way it's done in L.A. They auditioned for her. She's the clearinghouse, she and her assistants. And then they narrowed it down. This is the normal process, pretty much professionally everywhere. And Cincinnati really does have a really amazing, there's a very large professional casting base and a really substantial crew base here too, because of all the productions that are brought here, as well as some that originate. And so then, you know, I went through and I picked, and the only person that she was having trouble really nailing, she found me some just ringers. Just amazing people. And the only one that she really was having trouble nailing, and I ended up going out of town for, was Frederick Ng Lee, the guy that had ended up playing Hiro, just because I needed a professional actor, not somebody who maybe showed promise and months from now I could get there, you know. And Frederick is a pro and works in the business in LA, and he just was right. So we brought Fred in. But otherwise, everybody was cast professionally through this agency here, and they did a great job, just a wonderful job. We have people looking at our films, Healing River, our other films, and just saying, can't believe this was done in Hollywood with seasoned Hollywood actors. These guys are all such gifted professional actors. And we just say, well, yeah, we got them.
So how long did it actually take to shoot Godzilla from start to finish?
Amazingly short. Time is money when you're making a movie, not just as a general business expression, because every day you're shooting, you're paying for things. You're paying by the day or by the week. You're paying for the actors, for the crew, for the meals, for rental equipment of all kinds. We created a soundstage studio to shoot in out of an old H.H. Gregg electronics store. It was a chain that went out of business. And in a mall right near our production office, there's this huge, like, I don't know, 60-something, 70-something thousand square foot space with even some side rooms, one of which became Richard Blowhart's office. But we had room for these three sound stages, and we were time conscious because per day we're paying X amount of dollars to make this movie. And so we tried to work very efficiently. We shot a lot of scenes in one particular 1960s era tech warehouse production building in Cincinnati that doubled for all kinds of things. We shot down at the Cincinnati Riverfront, quite a few things there. And then we shot at all the miniatures, all the monster stuff, all the rear screen projection, which makes up a huge chunk of the movie. Probably well over a third of the movie. We shot in this H.H. Gregg store on three different stages. One was our monster stage, one was our rear projection stage, and one was our miniatures stage. We would shoot the miniatures on a tiny stage, blow them up, below and project them onto the rear screen projection stage to put them behind Godzilla or to put them behind the actors. And we would have three, four different layers, and we would move from stage to stage as we assembled these layers, which is exactly how it was done on a, is done on a much bigger stage by Toho in Japan.
That's actually a good segue to my next question. I know that you decided to do as much of the film practically as possible, and you had the, you just talked about the rear projection as opposed to just green screen and very little CGI, but what made you want to stick with those approaches?
Well, on the one hand, it was, there was a practical time-saving element to it. It meant doing less really difficult to execute effects in post-production purely digitally. Mostly we just relied on digital for a few little subtle touch-ups here and there for effects that we just couldn't practically create. But also, from the start, I'd always wanted to do this the way the kinds of movies... There, our story takes place in 62, and our movie, if it was real, truly a movie from that era, would have been done this way. Our DP, director of photography, Jeff, Jeff said, what do you want it to look like? And I said, I want it to look like old Technicolor. I want it to be really color rich and color saturated, or if you will, like Toho color, you know. And I want it to be scope, widescreen, because that was something they moved into in the early 60s to give these otherwise modestly budgeted monster movies a lavish kind of a look, is rich color and widescreen. And so we gave it that look of that era, that real rich color saturation. Jeff shot using an old Technicolor lens on the camera to give it the right, I mean, the real subtle feel that only another director, another cinematographer would know, but the audience would feel it. They would sense that it looked right, you know. We used the rear screen projection, partly practically, but also because Jeff had wanted for years to do a movie like this. And Jeff said, Mitch, please, 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 let me do it this way. Let me do it this way. And I said, can we pull it off? And he said, on our budget? And he said, yes, we can, we can. And so we went for it. And yeah, we did rear screen projection instead of much more subtle, contemporary, potentially modern looking digital stuff. We really went for it. And it gave the actors, they could turn around and look up at Godzilla. They could look at the tanks behind them. They could interact with stuff because it was literally on the screen behind them, and it gave it. And the actors had a ball doing it too. Even the extras did. When we shot a close up of the train, which was just a mock up of the side of a train with the windows in front of the actors who were sitting behind these windows. They got to react to the stuff on the screen, and they got such a kick out of it. It enhanced their performances. So it made the whole thing uniquely fun as well as uniquely authentic. Also, side note, Jacob Baker builds his cosplay. He built Godzilla exactly the way the original Godzilla was built, the same structural form, the same way of building the skeleton from the from the ground out, and then padding it with what really is furniture foam, then hand cutting and shaping and melting and burning furniture foam, and then layering it on top with a plastic foam. And it just, the whole thing was, it turned into kind of a point of pride to us that we were doing it just like it would have been done in 1962.
In terms of the creature design, it obviously looks like a riff on, you know, Godzilla and the other, you know, dinosaurian kaiju, but how'd you come up with that exact look for the monster? I mean, everything from, you know, the zipper and the chest and the design of the spines and stuff like that.
Well, when I wrote the earliest draft, or at least the draft that I eventually pitched to Hollywood and to Warner Brothers and so on. When I wrote that draft, I did a lot of thinking about what, and I did a lot of sketching. I'm not a terrific artist, but I can get my ideas across. I did all my storyboarding for this, and it, you know, people can understand what I'm trying to show them with the storyboards. And so, as I thought about it, I thought, well, what really feels right, but is also funny? And he drinks a ton of beer. And so he has this beer belly. He's got this, protruding belly. We're making fun of the fact that there's a stuntman inside. So we put the zipper right up the front, which, of course, no Godzilla or any kaiju movie coming out of Japan would ever have a zipper at all, much less an exposed, visible one in the front. Making fun of the fins on the back, instead of imitating Godzilla's fins, we went our own way and gave him the paper doll cutout, string of paper dolls along the back, which is just kind of lovable. Jacob added his own elements to it. He brought certain touches to it, my favorite of which is the big childlike eyes and the kind of, when he did, he created baby Godzilla first, the little guy that pops out of the egg, who everybody's in love with. I mean, everybody wants a puppet of this guy. Baby Godzilla is adorable, but he gave him these two little pointy buck teeth in front. And everybody just said, ah, the teeth. So we kept the teeth because, after all, full grown Godzilla is still really just like a week old by the end of the movie. We had fun with the fact that he's a kid too, and a lot of that was Jacob's addition.
So kind of getting to the things with the miniatures, and I already know you said a lot of it was kind of budgetary restrictions, just in terms of how it a lot of it might look intentionally fake, whether it's stuff like the zipper or the cutting the visible strings toy army men, stuff like that. It's one of those things where, I know you said it's kind of making fun of yourself too. Was there a kind of balance you were trying to keep in mind between, parody and, making sure the people watching don't think that it's like a more something more malicious, something that's like making fun of the classic films. Was that a balance that you were conscious of when you were making the movie and coming up with some of those jokes?
Yeah, I think so. I think in a sense, once we realized that we were working with a much smaller stage, talking about the rear projection stage, I started going with a more self-consciously stagey style and that fit in with the less realistic looking miniatures. If Godzilla represents a level of realism, let's say compared to a modern $200 million digitally computer animated creature movie, if that's a 10, and probably it isn't, but say that's a 9. If the old classic kaiju movies from the 60s and 70s are maybe a 6 or a 7, in that they're really artful for what they are, but they're not as completely believable as, say, the latter generation of Steven Spielberg, even it's dated now in a way, but Jurassic Park, where everybody was... When Jurassic Park came out, everybody said, this looks real. I don't have that, oh, it's convincing for what it is. Feel, it looks real to me. So maybe that's as close to the 10 as you get. We decided, well, we can't even get close to the 6 of a, or 7 of a Toho movie, that level of finesse. And so let's have fun with that. Let's play with that enough that our style settles for a spoofier, goofier kind of middle, where we're spending a lot of time making fun of ourselves too. There's a lot of little jokes making fun of ourselves in the movie. The spirit of the whole thing is really genuinely an affectionate send up. It's kind of a tribute in its own way. And the kaiju fans have gotten that totally. That's exactly how they've reacted to it. At G-Fest last year, which is where it premiered, two sold-out, packed, standing-room-only screenings. Both of them stood and cheered for like 5-10 minutes after the film. And afterwards, right away, we knew they get it. They get it. Didn't offend them. it was right in the pocket for them. You know, they took it the way we meant it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I guess in terms of the actual effects, you know, the vehicles and miniature sets, what was the process like in creating those? Were those things that you guys built in-house, the tanks, boats, planes, things like that?
That's one way that we were not able to manage the craftsmanship of a Toho production. But the original Godzilla movie used a man that was already, at that time, legendary miniatures builder. I mean, he was famous for what he could do. And he built he and his team, much larger team than we could dream of having, built detailed miniatures beyond what we could do. So right off the bat, we knew we needed to beg, borrow, steal, tweak, add to. And when we couldn't, we'd make fun of and have fun with the thing that we couldn't do, play with it, you know. We did get a number of really, really valuable miniature or scenery pieces, including the train, beautiful, I forget what they call the scale. It's the larger scale than the little HO. But we had a beautiful train from a train museum here in the Cincinnati area called Intertrainment Junction. And they were really helpful. We've
been doing
some shooting there, but...
Intertrainment Junction's awesome. Yeah, that's a great... That's a cool little thing, yeah.
Yeah, they contributed some great stuff, including the beautiful train, which is of the era that we used in the film. We played with the fact... I mean, their train was more realistic. They would never do this, but because I thought it was a great gag, I loved it. When we get into the close-ups, when we see the train going by, we see the silhouetted cutouts stuck on the windows of passengers, backlit, very phony looking. But then we cut to close-ups of real people looking out the windows and screaming. And the juxtaposition of real people and the cutouts was a gag in itself. And then we have Nazilla peeling off the cutouts, just making fun of ourselves.
Yeah, that's a great gag, by the way.
As he drops them, we see real people falling through the air. So we had a lot of fun with that bit. So those are the ways that we worked with what we had and turned, you know, lemons into lemonade.
For those not familiar with Intertainment Junction here in Cincinnati, there's like a little, basically you walk in and they have gigantic model trains built out. And these things are huge. I mean, they're the size of movie sets in many respects. It's an awesome place to take your kids. And so I'm glad to know that actually is what I was looking at, because that's a cool place. I've taken my son there a couple times. He loves it.
Yeah. And the founder and owner of the place there is, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. I'm blanking. Forgive me. But he was just good as gold. He was really, really helpful. He just gave us his tour to end all tours and pointed every little thing that we could possibly tap into and use. And yeah, they were great. As far as other stuff goes, our production designer, Gabby Lithseal, Gabby is just brilliant. She had done all kinds of really, really neat props on a couple of other movies I've done. She's a real master prop maker, some really masterful detailed props. So I knew that she'd never done a movie doing miniatures per se, but I knew she had the skill set and the creativity to do that. So we did borrow a lot of pieces from Intertrainment Junction, building pieces and things, but we supplemented like the tower, the beer tower, on top of a skyscraper in downtown Cincinnati that Nazilla rips the beer can, that what's really a giant beer vat, rips it off of and uses it like a beer can. There's a billboard behind it advertising the brand of beer, Padiddle Beer, with a Padiddle Time on the sign. And, she created that. She created all kinds of foreground miniatures and then background miniatures, which we shot those in front of. Backgrounds were actually not miniatures, but they were photographic plates of downtown Cincinnati shot from rooftops of other buildings so that we got that monster's eye view level angle. And some shots shooting up from the ground for people's, the people on the ground's point of view. So we pre-planned with the storyboarding the layers that we would need and put those together.
Sweet. What would you say the biggest challenges were during the shoot itself?
Time was number one. And a wonderful cast, wonderful crew. All I would have asked for, I might have asked for a few more people to take some of the weight off, especially our miniatures team. There were three of them, three miniatures, and a couple of people came in once or twice to extra, do some extra work. But three people trying to do the work that on a Toho movie would be 40 people. And we shot the film in 17 days. The original Godzilla shot in something like 4 months, you know. Which is not to say it's not done. Low-budget indies are done in that time frame, typically. They're just not done with this kind of a movie. So, again, we had to think smart. We had to think fast. We had to think creative. You know, how do we make this work for us? How do we create a full-on, I meant that, on the screen? Never a moment where the audience goes, too bad they couldn't have done it better. And they don't. Instead, they really feel that they're laughing with the style that we adopted. More time would have been number one. Some more crew to help out, some of our overworked people. The cast really came through great. One thing that I did on my previous film and with this one is that the week before production, I met with my lead players for 3 solid days and just rehearsed all the main scenes with them. And just made sure they really got where we were going with it. So they were really ready to start shooting when they arrived on set a week later.
Awesome. So we are winding down a bit. Being from Cincinnati myself and actually still living here, I want to talk about some of the Cincinnati references. So first question I have to ask you, Skyline Chili or Gold Star Chili?
Well, I've been thinking lately maybe I'd try Gold Star again, but I was always kind of more Skyline guy.
That is the only that is the correct answer. You can't. I've never met a person that loves Gold Star that I've liked, so it's always got to be Skyline.
Actually, there's a new place in OTR over the Rhine that does a kind of a gourmet version of Cincinnati style chili that I'd really like to try. I forget the name of the place though.
There's another good place, Blue Ash Chili. That's pretty decent.
I haven't tried Blue Ash. I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah, Blue Ash. They also have these gigantic, like, double-decker, triple-decker sandwiches that are great. So chili aside, I got to ask you, and I was cracking up, but, like, the oyster crackers. Like, every time you go into those chili restaurants, everybody's, like, chowing down. They give you bowls and bowls and bowls full of oyster crackers. That's a real thing that happens here in Cincinnati. Yeah, I don't know if that's a thing in other cities or not, but like that's a thing that we do.
Yeah,
in Michigan, because I'm in the Detroit area. We have a similar we have the Coney dog, and you know that's like a chili dog. So we have a similar chili thing going on. But yeah, we're not obsessed with the oyster crackers. We do have a similar feuding Detroit Coney place, Lafayette, and. I can't even remember the other one. National. And they're literally next to each other. Like the buildings are next to each other. One of the gags I liked is, and it's like blink and you miss it, but the close up of the package of oyster crackers, it says something like contains crack or something.
it says now with real crack.
One of the other thing I just wanted to talk about some of the other Cincy locations. So like obviously you had the shots of downtown, you had the Roebling Bridge. I noticed like the 513, which is the Cincinnati area code, and the power plant and the underground. Any other things that you kind of crammed in there intentionally, or any other references that you wanted to make sure we didn't miss?
Yeah, we didn't want to do too much. You don't want to cross a line and make the movie just for locals. You want the movie to work anywhere, not just in the U.S. even, and in other countries, because, I mean, a huge percentage of the world can watch this movie, in English for that matter, you know, dubbed. It'd be interesting if it, and when it gets to Japan, it'll be, we'll be seeing dubbed into Japanese, which is kind of a flip flop of the normal. But it, you know, we wanted it to be able to travel well. And so we kept them subtle enough, like the oyster crackers gag is one that would be kind of funny to somebody, even if they didn't know about Cincinnati chili places and how people eat the oyster crackers, like they really have crack in them. And so, you know, we tried to make it work a couple of ways. There's a joke about the fact that everything is a reference to how close it is to Cincinnati. Even Indiana is described as western Cincinnati. And then in parentheses, in quotes, like it's what they call it, it says, AKA Indiana. so, you know, we had fun without making the movie a local movie.
Matt, did you recognize any of the scenery or anything?
Yeah, like the bridge is the main thing that you kind of see, and like the riverfront, the water, which is the Ohio River. Then you have like the hill that they're actually, what it ended up being like kind of the composite shot, right? But like there's actually, when you drive through Cincinnati and you go down 75, there's a big building that actually has Cincinnati written on it and like these gigantic letters, and like they change the color of the letters sometimes during certain seasons of the year and stuff. So like all that stuff was really easily recognizable. And then like the PNC Bank was in a couple shots and stuff like that.
Yeah. That's all. We went up and shot the background you're talking about. We shot it on the hillside where the old Cincinnati Christian University was, that they're not there anymore, but the parking lot up there. I taught filmmaking classes there for a number of years. And so I knew about the view from the parking lot. So, you know, I pre-scouted locations when I was even when I was writing the script, I would have in mind where we would shoot things. And I knew we would shoot that grand finale ridge scene up front, with that as the rear projected backdrop.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. There's a scene with like the toy steamboat, which is a huge thing here in Cincinnati. You got like, There's a bunch of companies. There's a haunted house on a steamboat every Halloween here in Cincy. And there's, it's like, I liked and enjoyed all the references. And by the way, the oyster crackers thing killed me, because I don't even know if I explained it well to listeners, but they bring out bowls and bowls of crackers for people as they're waiting on like their chili spaghetti. Like,
yeah,
people just down those things. And then if you buy Coney's and you're going to the drive through, they give you like 12 bags of oyster crackers. Like that's the expectation. You don't ask for them. They include that in every single order. So,
Was the diner at a particular local spot?
Oh yeah. We shot it at. I'm ashamed to say I'm forgetting the name of the diner. It's actually a really well loved diner that's in the Carew Tower building here, which is sort of the old iconic. There are two really iconic towers. One, the old one, the Carew Tower, and the other is the new one, the Great American Tower. And in the Carew Tower is this 50s, 60s style diner. And
is it Hathaway's? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And we shot in Hathaway's. Yeah.
Have you been there, man?
We get it during the night. You know, when they're closed. So we shot all night from like closing time. We started trucking in things and shot till the early hours of the morning, and then got all our diner scenes in there.
Yeah, that's down on, I think it's Vine Street. If you're from this area, you know where it's at. But I've never eaten there. That's something I need to definitely check out.
Yeah.
Go in and tell them they should put a big plaque up that says filming location of Notzilla.
Hey, they may. It opened last week and it's starting to really pick up steam now. There's more and more buzz about it every day. So we'll see. Maybe the thing that really just blessed us is right off the bat, Movie Web, which has a huge following. MovieWeb's reviewer said that he thought this was a classic in the making, a cult classic in the making, and we couldn't be happier with the idea of it becoming a cult classic.
Well, in terms of spoofs, I think it's the last like 10 to 20 years have been very dark, dark times for the spoof film. And, you know, this is probably one of the more effective ones. I mean, you get stuff like, what's one of them? I don't know, like Date Movie or whatever. And those are just like the worst. And this does have more of the old school spoof kind of vibe to it. So I think it'll be a welcome addition to that. And yeah, I mean, it's out there and people can see it pretty easily now.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of spoofs in the last couple of decades have been kind of cobbled together. Let's just throw a bunch of jokes together without any real cohesiveness, no real solid storyline or main character development or anything. Not that I tease and say that this is really deep, but there was some, you know, the characters are pretty well developed and kind of well defined and a lot of those are really just sort of slapped together and they also rely really, really heavily on crude stuff. You know, they're always R-rated and they rely very much on crude sex-oriented jokes. And our production company makes movies for families, so that wasn't going
to
fly.
And they're all like references to something in pop culture. Like, I mean, if you go and watch one from like 10 years ago, you probably won't even remember half the stuff it's even referencing, you know?
Yeah.
I hate that approach to it.
Yeah, I think the best parodies, and some of them are kind of hybrid, they're not pure parody, they're sort of part parody, are those that are just really faithful to what they're trying to do.
Right.
You know, Anchorman is a funny, funny movie. I mean, you kind of have to go back a ways, really. It's been a while, but Tropic Thunder, you know, some of the stuff Ben Stiller's done in the past. In recent years, it's been a long dry spell. It really has. That's why we said, well, let's do a kind of a throwback style. Let's think Zucker Brothers.
So, you know, you'd mentioned your other film, Healing River, and you, how it's this, you know, faith-based drama, and then you have this crazy, wacky kaiju comedy on the other end. Where do you have any idea of kind of like what direction you're gonna go next? Are you gonna kind of do you think you'll be doing you know, more faith-based kind of, or dramatic material or another comedy or another parody, or, you know, do you have any, because those are like the about as different as you can get, you know, is there a certain direction that you feel like at the moment you want to kind of stick with, or are you just kind of up for anything?
Well, I mean, in my heart of hearts, if somebody told me you can only work in one sort of genre, which I hope and pray nobody ever tells me that, because I really like changing from project to project. But, you know, I'm kind of a comedy drama or dramedy guy. I like to tell a story. I want to make people cry and laugh, you know, and I also want to make them think. I want them to come away something that really sticks in their heart, but also in their brain, that really rattles around in there. Healing River is an attempt to do that, but it's more overtly faith-based. It is and it isn't. It's also considered really edgy for a faith-based movie. It's a PG-13 movie. And all the reviews on Amazon, although they're raves, say, wow, this is just so much more real, so much more edgy and real than they're used to faith-based movies being, which tend to kind of play it safe. But on the other hand, if I do a movie that's not considered a faith-based movie, that's quote secular, there's an element of spirituality, of God stuff in there, because that's who I am. That's the next. I have two projects in the works right now that I'm actively going to be pitching. I've been waiting for things to calm down enough for me to start the active pitching process. One is a faith-based rom-com, romantic comedy, and I won't say anything more except that it's about a one-time A-list Hollywood actor who's shooting a film on location at a faith-based Christian university in the Cincinnati area, and gets all fight. He's playing a teacher in the movie he's doing, and he gets all fired up and decides on the spur of the moment he's going to quit acting and become a teacher. He falls in love with an English prof at the university, and it's loosely based on my relationship with my wife and how we met. So that's one, and it's a rom-com with fairly healthy mix of humor, but also more serious and more real in tone and much more message, subtly messagey than Nautilus. But then the other one would be considered a secular movie. It's a fantasy called Barthland, and it's a story of a guy who is invaded by a fleet of microscopic spacecraft and wakes up to find that he's been turned into a nation, Barthland. His last name is Barth. There is actually a surprisingly, I want you to try to explain how it's, the flavor is kind of Bruce Almighty, but there's an element, while it's not a faith-based movie, there's an element of learning to believe in someone, something bigger and more important than yourself, and so on. But I'll be pitching that to the secular, the regular mainstream production companies too.
Awesome. The final question for you, where can people find you or your projects online? Are you on Twitter? Do you have a social media presence that people can reach out to you if they want to learn, know more?
Yeah, absolutely. Just speaking for me personally, because of course the production company has a website too, of stmichaelmovies.com. My website is just my name. The key there is spelling it right. Although I'm actually the only Mitch Teamley in the world. Even if you spell it wrong, you'll probably find it. But it's MitchTeamley.com, and Teamley is T-E-E-M-L-E-Y. I write about everything on my blog. I'm an active blogger. I have a large following, and they're my tribe. They really are my people. I write about everything. I do a lot of posts that are about my film projects, and those are generally use the subtitle A Filmmaker's Journal. And so I do keep people up on developments on my film projects. And currently I'm putting together a publishing deal for the novelization of Healing River. That's actually talked about on there too, and will be more and more as we proceed.
All right. Well, that's about all we got as far as questions. I mean, that Nautzilla went through a pretty painful production process. So, I mean, congratulations on finally getting it done and getting it in front of audiences. I mean, that's one of the movies I missed at G-Fest, but just overall, it seems like the fandom has been really positive about it. And, congratulations on getting it on, it's streaming, it's on Blu-ray. I mean, people can find it pretty easily. Thank you for not only making a decent kaiju movie with no money, but also a decent spoof movie, which also doesn't happen very often. So, congratulations. And yeah, I mean, all the best of luck in getting your other projects off the ground. And it was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. It was fun.
All right. Well, yeah, we're I think ready to head out. So, thanks again and good night.
Yeah, thanks, good Mitch. Night. And keep your roar. Get your roar on.
Thank you for listening to the Kaiju Transmissions podcast. Please take a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher. Make sure to subscribe for all the latest episodes. You can also check us out on Twitter at KT_podcast. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook at Kaiju Transmissions. And you can email us at kaijutransmissions@gmail.com if you have any questions or comments. And we will see you next time.